Hear Me Roar with Valerie Mulcahy is funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.
What makes sportswomen tick? What motivates us? What inspires us? Who is the person behind the athlete? My name is Valerie Mulcahy. I'm a 10-time All-Ireland winner with Cork and a 6-time All-Star. Now I'm turning host and talking to some of Cork's greatest sports stars, are those who have a strong connection with Cork. In this series, I'm speaking to 6 inspiring athletes to find out their answers to these questions. This is Hear Me Roar with Valerie Mulcahy.
I got the eye of the tiger, a fighter, dancing through the fire, 'cause I am a champion.
The first episode is with a trailblazing Irish golfer who has since retired from professional golf and turned her hand to dentistry.
Hi, I'm Lisa McGuire, former professional golfer, and you're listening to Hear Me Roar with Valerie Mulcahy.
Lisa and her twin sister Leona were trailblazers for women's golf in this country. Lisa is now full-time at University College Cork studying dentistry. We spoke about her origins in the sport, how she knew it was time to step away, her relationship with her twin sister Leona, and much more. But first, she told me how she's settling into her new home on the banks of the Lee.
So far, so good. Starting to feel a bit more like home away from home, I suppose. So first year wasn't down here at all. Last year was the first year settling in, so definitely starting to find my feet more and more.
So what are you studying in college that brought you here?
Dentistry, for my sins.
Okay. Tough, is it?
It's not too bad. I suppose coming back into college after being like out of it for a while was tough, trying to get settled back into it, get back into the swing of things. But starting to find my feet more and more. There's lots of Canadian students over that are kind of more my age, so it was kind of nice kind of settling back in. I didn't feel like I was absolutely ancient compared to everyone coming out of Leaving Cert. But little by little, getting stuck in. This year's a lot more practical. So taking it as it comes.
But you've already done 4 years in America?
I've already done 4 years, so this is year 7 in college, yeah. So okay. I just can't seem to get away from it.
So I suppose bringing it back to where golf began, like, was it in your DNA, or how did you set out playing golf?
No, I mean, it probably was the furthest thing that was kind of in the beginning. I suppose Dad was, well, he still is, a huge, huge sports fan, and sport was something that kind of we grew up kind of right in the middle of at home. But it was like, it was everything else other than golf. Like, Dad played golf, but it was the last thing that myself or Leona wanted to do. We thought it was very uncool. It was a game for old people, and we'd much rather play football. We did a lot of swimming, like basically everything else that, you know, involved a ball or a stick. But I mean, 1 year, I think we were maybe 10 at the time, I fell, broke my elbow, ended up kind of carrying a little bit, lost a bit of range of motion, and the specialist was like, listen, you're going to have to do something or you're going to lose the range of motion in that arm. And Dad was like, you know what, I've been trying to get them out for years to play golf. The specialist said tennis, and I think Dad translated that to golf, brought us up on the small par tree course, Steve Russell, and that was kind of it.
My God, so it's amazing how you fall into things, and Leona will have a lot to thank. Did she probably push you? She did.
I was good. That was the kind of the thing, I suppose. That was the first real individual sport we kind of played. So it was kind of nice, the fact we had each other. I suppose when we were growing up, we did everything together. So even though it was me that had the broken arm and needed to get the motion back, it was kind of a paired activity, I suppose. Wherever I went, she went. So it was kind of nice that we had each other. It was something that everybody else didn't have.
Life on the road as a pro golfer can be a tough and even a lonely existence. Living out of a suitcase in a different hotel room each week, rushing from one tournament to the next, all the while trying to fit in gym work and rest. Lisa admits her schedule was grueling. Like, what I found fascinating is when I went to Dromoland, and one of the girls was, so that she had her own, she didn't have a caddy, so she was carrying her own golf bag. It's quite a heavy golf bag, and Dromoland is a long course.
Yeah, it's a hilly course.
Long course, you're like, me trying to play it on the pro-am, but she had carried her bag. It was about 5.5 hours. She was after coming in, and we were chatting to her, lovely girl, Anna from Spain, and she said she was going to the gym to do workout and stretching and stuff.
Hmm.
And I was just like, is rest not more important here? But like the life of a pro,
yeah.
Like, can you give us a glimpse of it? Because I know many people have ambitions of being pro at something, but maybe the glamour, they think it's all glamour. What's it really like? And yeah. what turns you off it, essentially?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, you know, a lot of people assume that golf is kind of, you know, it's a tournament played on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, if you're lucky. But in reality, it's kind of, it's more of like a week, 1 week runs into the next week, runs into the next week. So kind of if you're starting out, let's say coming from home, heading right to a tournament, chances are you're flying out there Sunday night or early Monday morning, you're picking up your rental car, you're driving to the tournament, you're probably playing a practice round. Again, if you're on some of the kind of the mini tours, you're definitely carrying your own golf bag. You're doing anything, I suppose, to save as many costs as you can. You're practicing Monday. You're probably playing holes. You're maybe going to the gym in the afternoon. You get up Tuesday morning, you do the same again. You play, you practice, go to the gym, do whatever you need to do. Wednesday, you usually play a pro-am of some sort.
That's where you're cursed to yourself, yeah.
But yeah, you play a pro-am on the Wednesday and then everything kicks off on the Thursday, and you play Thursday, you play Friday. If you make the cut, you play Saturday, Sunday. And I suppose if you don't make the cut, you spend Saturday and Sunday practicing, you know, for the next week that's coming. And literally when things finish up on the Saturday night, you get in your car, you either go to the airport and you drive to the next one, and everything starts again on Monday. So there's no real, you know, break as such. And there's at times, you know, when we're playing on the Symmetra Tour over in the US, you might drive 7, 8, 9 hours from one event to the next event, and you just repeat it again. And I suppose that's the thing, when things are going well, you can, you know, you take time off and you're easier on yourself. If things aren't going well, you're literally going 24/7 one week into the next week, and I suppose it just ends up in a vicious cycle. You don't take time off and you feel like you need to, you know, do more when less sometimes is more.
Oh, I understand. And did you experience burnout?
Oh yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. I suppose it definitely got to a point, you know, you felt exhausted, but you couldn't sleep. I suppose that was kind of what it got for me. I was like, I was tired. I didn't know what was wrong, but at the same time, I knew I needed to work hard. That was never something that I resented. I always got up and, you know, if the day before hadn't gone well, I try and like rectify it and feel like I had to find something the next day, and then it's grand, I'll find it tomorrow, and then, oh, I found it, lost it, and I think it becomes a cycle where you just kind of, you're going chasing your tail round and round and round, and it's a never ending cycle, and it ends up in a burnout where you kind of, you don't know where you are or what you're doing, and it's easy to kind of lose yourself in that, I suppose.
But like, who's there to look after you in those moments? Like, who's there on the tour that can tell you, like, Lisa, you just actually need to step back, or there's actually nothing wrong. Maybe it's just you're overthinking it,
yeah.
Or you're trying to compensate, or you're nearly searching too much. Yeah. So, like, is there anyone around that is kind of the go-to person, or do you have to hire those people?
No, I suppose a lot of people would probably look to like maybe a sports psychologist. I suppose that's kind of up to you. Some people do, some people don't. Or again, it's just having a good group of like friends around you. Like, there's a lot of girls out there that are doing life on tour for I don't know how many years at this stage, kind of doing the same thing year in, year in, year out. And I suppose that's nice that they have kind of the shared experiences and everyone's in the same boat. Like, everyone's not going to have an amazing year every year, and you'll always have weeks that kind of you can rely on people and be in the same boat as people. But I suppose it's just, you know, when you're going back to a hotel room or going back to an Airbnb and whatever else it is, and things aren't going well, you know, it does seem like a very lonely place, and you can seem kind of like you're a million miles away from something when you're actually not that far away. You know, sometimes it's you're only one good round away from kind of turning things around. But yeah, no, it definitely can. You can feel like you're a million miles away and kind of, you know, in a bad spot.
A lot of young people who take it up tend to be turned off by it, by their late teens maybe, or there's a big dropout rate. I wonder, is some of that to do with the individuality of the sport, and maybe it's the way it's so isolated, and it is so much in your head too, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely it. I mean, it's so much nicer to be able to go even to football training or soccer training or basketball training, whatever it is. There's like a good group of people there. You go with your friends and, you know, you have the crack and you get stuck in and do whatever you need to do when you're there. But I suppose golf just doesn't necessarily have that same social element. And I suppose, again, that was the same thing for us when we were growing up. We were the only two girls that were playing at our club, some of the very few people of our own age even. So yeah, we played with the boys and whatever else, but it didn't have the same maybe appeal as it would to go to football training or camogie training or whatever it was. So I definitely think that plays a huge role. I think it's got better now over the last couple of years. There's definitely more and more younger people playing, but it's definitely something that does affect people playing, you know, the loneliness of it, I suppose, and the individuality of it. It's just not, doesn't quite have the same appeal as the team dynamics.
Do you understand the significance of yourself and Leona's impact that you've had on young people and getting them into a game that maybe you saw when you were younger as an old person's sport?
Yeah, I think so. I suppose for me, I suppose even a couple of weeks ago, going down to Dromoland to the Irish Open, I mean, it was the first time I was back in 10 years. And to even see the progression of, you know, the crowds and maybe the demographic of the crowds that was out there. There were so many more young girls out there. There were so many, so much more of a younger crowd, I suppose. It wasn't like your stereotypical, you know, middle-aged men, women, kind of retirees that were out watching. It was a huge cohort of young people, and I suppose that was nice to see how far it has come. And, you know, even I see how many letters and messages Leona gets from young girls saying that, you know, that they've started playing golf because of Leona and whatever else. So, I mean, that's pretty special to see that it has come a long way in even the last 10 to 15 years, you know.
Lisa's twin sister Leona continues to play on the LPGA Tour, winning her first tour title last year, the Drive On Championship in Florida. I asked Lisa, what is it like being constantly mistaken for a twin, as well as the intricacies of being a twin? At the moment, Leona's, you're probably compared to her, you can see yourself in her, but how do you deal with that in a day-to-day when you actually see yourself nearly in front of you? And everything, maybe there's a comparison that's often made or your family make without knowing it, or I don't know what, you know, the complexities that must come with being a twin.
Yeah, I suppose it's the question that people always ask is like, what is it like to be a twin? And I suppose my initial answer is, well, like, we don't know any different. And I suppose too, that's again what I've just said there. I refer to things a lot as we, you know, we did this, we did that, we went here when we were here. And I suppose it's only in kind of more recent times when we've kind of, the paths have kind of diverged slightly that, you know, it's I did this and I did that and she did this and she did that. So that definitely takes a little bit of time to get used to. But I think, we get on really well. We still get on really well. And I think kind of the way I talk and the way she still talks is just a byproduct of spending so much time together. You know, a lot of people think that we think the same and we tend to maybe finish each other's sentences. But I think that's just a byproduct of like spending so much time with each other. But I suppose growing up, we did everything together. You kind of had that built-in best friend. And I suppose that was kind of the nice thing. You never felt like you were going anywhere by yourself, or never felt you were kind of alone. And that was a huge help when we kind of moved to the States over to college. Kind of you had someone with you. Everyone else was kind of homesick and whatever. As far as we kind of had each other and it felt like normal, you know?
Yeah, but did you ever want to just go, do you know what? I think I want a different experience. I want to go somewhere else. Was that ever across your mind?
I suppose it probably didn't at the time. Probably looking back on it now, I suppose, would it have been a good thing? It might have been, you know. I suppose now, the last couple of years, I've kind of started more to figure out who I am rather than who we are, you know. And I suppose that just takes time, and I suppose that's part and parcel of kind of growing up and finding your own way. But it's definitely, I suppose, if it hadn't have been the best option for college, it was the best option that I was, the best college for golf. It was good for school, so it just kind of did fit that way. But I suppose it would have been very interesting to see if, you know, if she'd have preferred to go to school on the West Coast and I'd have preferred a school on the East Coast. I think we would have done it. I think it would have been tough in the beginning, I suppose. But it definitely, sometimes I do think about it, it would have been an interesting sort of experience and see how it would have panned out.
Lisa announced her retirement in late 2019, in just her second year on the Pro Tour. She had missed the schedule, along with frustrations about not being able to develop her game as much as she would have liked, led to her decision to retire.
What made you say, look, I think I'm done?
Yeah, I suppose it probably came, it was towards the end of, I think it was 2019 at this stage, and I, you know, had gone from week to week to week throughout Europe, kind of done a bit in the US, and I suppose I remember when I come back from playing in Spain maybe, and come back to the room by myself, and I was thinking, I was after looking up the girl that I played with, and she'd been out on tour for a number of years, and she was 35 maybe, and she'd been out on tour like 15 years or whatever, and I could see what she was doing, and like she was still playing away, doing her best, trying her best, and I was kind of like, you know what, I was like, I don't want to be in that position. I don't want to be, you know, in 15 years kind of banging my head against the wall and kind of having regrets that way. So you know, it never got to a point. Some people get to a point where, you know, they resent the game and they resent everything they've put into it and feel like it was a waste of their time. I suppose I never got to that point, and I kind of always promised myself that I wouldn't get to that point, that I wouldn't get to a point where I was like, I absolutely hate this and I absolutely resent the people that, you know, did so much for me. And, you know, when I got to the point where I was like, you know what, there is, you know, there's life outside of golf, there's life beyond golf, and I can be happy doing other things, you know, it came to that point where I was like, you know, I do need to step away from kind of my own sake before I kind of bury myself into a hole that I'm not going to get out of. So, no, and I suppose it kind of came around quite quickly. I played the World Invitation in Galgorm, and I was kind of like, you know what, this is a nice one to finish on. And it was one of the events that I enjoyed the most, you know, in the series of those years, was kind of the last one. I felt like I could enjoy it a little bit more. I kind of felt like there was less pressure off and just kind of enjoyed the walk kind of as it was.
What do you think your biggest strength was as a player? Not in terms of, like, say, putting, which I know you're very strong at. But what was your biggest strength?
I suppose just the, even going back, like, day in, day out, just getting up the next day and kind of going back at it again. I suppose there was a game like golf, there'll always be more bad days than good days, there'll always be more bad shots than good shots, but being able to, you know, yesterday was a bad day, not a good day, and still getting up the next morning.
Perseverance.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
having another go and thinking that it's still only one shot away.
How are you going to enjoy golf now, where, you know, you can change your mindset on it, essentially? It's not going to be a stressor, I hope, for you. So, how are you going to approach golf now that you're back in love with it?
Yeah, I suppose that was the thing. That was the hardest thing, was, you know, from going literally practicing 10, 12 hours a day to kind of, you know what, I don't actually have to practice. I'm not going to go out and, like, hit balls and hit balls and hit balls. But then when I go out and play, I still have the same level of expectation that I had when I was, you know, playing 7 days a week and playing, you know, for 10 hours a day, you know. And I suppose it's managing those expectations and seeing that, you know what, I don't need to hold this putt to be able to pay rent or, you know, have enough money to enter the next tournament, or kind of just go about my daily basis. You know, it's now something that I do for fun, do for enjoyment, and do because I want to actually be there. So yeah, no, I think that takes time. Am I there yet? Probably not 100%, but we're getting there.
Good. When was there, or was there, a defining moment when you said, do you know what, I think I can give this a go? When was there that light bulb moment that, yeah, I'm actually good enough? I'm really good.
Yeah. I think it was maybe 2011. I think we were 16 again. It was in that TY year where golf was kind of everything. Played a European Championship out in Holland. Had a course record, was kind of leading going up the last day, and I ended up winning, I think, by 5 in the end. But it was, I suppose, that light bulb moment where, you know, you walk onto the range even on a practice day or a tournament day, and kind of people look around and they're like, oh, you're here. And you're just like, you know, you necessarily wouldn't have done it for anyone else, but, like, that sort of, you know, that you had kind of a persona, or that sort of, you know,
presence.
Yeah, not sort of fear factor, but, you know, when you kind of stood up on the tee and you kind of put your hand out to the competitor, that, you know, you're like, oh, I have this. And I suppose that was the kind of the thing, when you had that sort of confidence without necessarily knowing. Like, you didn't have to build that. It just, the confidence came from knowing, you know what, you know, I'm good at this, and, you know, I'm going to shoot a good round, and not kind of having to worry. I'd never had a sleepless night. They're being like, oh, will I play well tomorrow, will I not? Yeah, you were nervous because you wanted to do well, but you, at that you kind of had that quiet confidence that, you know what, I got this and I'm good at what I do.
Talk to me about your parents and maybe the influence they have. I know you spoke about your dad getting you into golf and your interest. I had the pleasure of meeting them at Drumholland, and your mom was telling us, I've never played golf.
No, I mean, mom's the most, she won't mind me saying this, she's the most unsporty, uncoordinated person you've ever met. And, like, even still down through the years, everyone will always say, would you ever take up the game, would you ever play a bit of golf? And she's no more interested in the man in the moon, but she'd follow us, you know, to the end of the world, kind of walking around golf courses, and she's picked up all the lingo, and she'll add her 2 cents in now, just over the last 15 years, haven't picked it up. But no, mom was great. She was kind of always the, with not having a sporting background, she was kind of more there just as a support structure more than anything else, you know, to put her arm around you after, you know, a tough day and be like, you know what, it's only golf. Whereas dad was like, you know, dad was more the sporting side of things and more the coaching side of things. I'd always had feedback on the way home or whatever else. But no, mom was kind of, was there for everything else, and she was great to kind of, even the logistics of it all, she always had everything done and always had the clothes washed and the food ready and the lunch packed and everything else. So, you know, it really does take a village to get you where you want to get.
I think so, and it does require maybe a bit of foresight on parents' parts. Like, I know mine were they built like a tennis court that turned into soccer pitch, really, and GA pitch, and like a basketball court area, and we were lucky enough to have land for that. But your situation is a little bit similar, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that was the thing when we were starting to play more full time, and kind of we were in school, and dad would bring us to the driving range in the evenings, to the floodlit driving range in the evenings. And I think we were definitely probably in first or second year at the time, and you know, the winter evenings were cold. And we do, again, we have a field up the back of the house, and dad had kind of rummaged and got these wooden pallets from the hardware shop or whatever that they weren't using, and he got two mats, and he'd set them outside, and I'll never forget, they're in the back street outside the house, and he'd set them, the wooden pallets, put the mat on top of them, threw them outside the back window of the house so that the light was coming out from the kitchen and we'd hit balls from the wooden pallets up into the backfield, so you could hit them maybe 120 yards up into the backfield out of the house. And Leona, we'd go out there every evening, put the coats on, go out, and it was absolutely Baltic, and Leona actually ended up getting pneumonia.
Oh my goodness.
So I think that Christmas mum was kind of like, you know what, this is actually madness and this has to stop. So I suppose at that time, dad, probably give him credit, had the foresight to, he put up a shed outside the back of the house, they remortgaged the house to build the shed so that we'd have somewhere to hit out of, so that the bays were kind of two mats side by side, were enclosed, shutter doors, so that we could hit up the backfield. So I suppose that's the sacrifice that they made to kind of, you know, make sure that we had at least the opportunity to kind of pursue our dreams kind of on a bigger stage. But yeah, no, that was definitely one to remember.
When did you start to appreciate that level of dedication on their part?
I suppose it's probably only, you know, now, even kind of when you're looking back, and I suppose at the time you kind of don't see the sacrifices. I suppose mom and dad never went on a holiday for the 15 years that we were kind of, you know, they were trotting around the globe with us, and every kind of penny went towards, you know, bringing us to tournaments and making sure we had all we needed to have. And I suppose it's only now that it's kind of nice to see, you know, them being able to enjoy it. And again, like when Leona plays in Dromoland and Leona plays in Galgorm, it's kind of nice that they're able to kind of come full circle and to be able to kind of look after them a little bit more the same way as they did us kind of growing up.
What advice would you give yourself now? If you were 10, what would you give your 10-year-old self? What advice would you give them?
I suppose as 10, it was probably quite a shy 10-year-old. I suppose there was, you know, sport, school, there wasn't a huge amount else happening. I suppose then kind of going into secondary school, I suppose just to not worry what other people thought and kind of just kind of beat to the sound of your own drum. I suppose even when we were playing golf was a bit weird, you know, at that time, kind of, you know, why would you play golf when you could play football or you could play anything else and do what everyone else is doing? And I suppose at that time too, there was a lot of things that we probably missed out on. There was a lot of things you couldn't go to because you were going to golf or you were away for a week and this and that. But I suppose at the time we didn't really see it. We enjoyed the golf and we looked forward to the trips and everything else, and we didn't really see it as a sacrifice. But there was definitely times where you'd be like, oh, I wish I could go that, or why do I have to go home early because we have to go to such and such tomorrow. But I suppose just it's the same as any sort of teenager, kind of, you know, if it's what makes you happy, go for it and don't let anybody else kind of tell you otherwise.
Solid advice. And would you alter that any bit for your 20-year-old self?
Yeah,
heading into their 20s, you're still in.
Yeah, I suppose you could still continue that sort of mantra kind of as you go into your 20s. I suppose everybody's just trying to find themselves a little bit in their 20s, and I suppose that was the thing too when you move halfway across the world, you know, to go to college away from home for the very first time, you know, that you kind of have the opportunity, I suppose, to reinvent yourself somewhat. So I suppose that was the nice thing, we kind of had that opportunity to kind of, you know, a little bit more freedom, a little bit more independence, decide who you want to be and kind of who you are as a person and have that sort of experience. So I often think sometimes, do I regret going to college in the States? Probably not. It gave me a lot of other experiences that I necessarily wouldn't have had if I'd have stayed here.
Before we wrapped up, I asked Lisa if there was anything she'd like to ask me, and I also asked my students at Gaelic Leinster AG to come up with a question for her.
if you met, let's say, your 15-year-old self now, walking the halls of the secondary school, and if she met you now, would she be proud of what she sees and what you've done?
I'd hope she'd be proud, yeah, because as a young 15-year-old, yeah, I wasn't confident in myself and who I was. I guess a lot of that came with my sexuality, but I was confident and most comfortable on the pitch. So sport helped me a huge amount with that, but I would definitely have said it's okay to be you and just embrace yourself and, you know, be kind and you'll be fine.
Sounds like a good idea.
I have one other thing. So each guest is going to leave a question for the next guest, not knowing who that guest is. And I've done a bit of questioning some students and teachers and my staff. So I've got the first one for you because you're our first guest. So the question is, have you ever felt spoken down to because you're a female? So has someone spoken down to you, like a coach or a male coach maybe, or a broadcaster or someone in the realm, in your few years, short years in playing golf?
Yeah, I suppose golf is one of those sports that's still very, well, you know, considered more elitist, I suppose, than more sports. And I suppose even growing up, there were certain golf courses where as a woman you couldn't play, you had to be invited to play, or you could only play with your husband or whatever else. And there was a couple of times we went to courses, and they used to have we had an event over in Scotland, over in Troon, Royal Troon, where there was two golf courses. So Royal Troon's the main golf course, is on the British Open Road, is across the road, and the Portland course, which is considered the women's course, is kind of the other side of the road. And I suppose we'd gone there one day, and we'd kind of arrived, and you normally when you'd arrive, you go into the pro shop just to check things out and get a yardage book and on whatever. And Dad was with us at the time. It was myself, Neon, and Dad, and we were walking up to the clubhouse, and this kind of man came out to the clubhouse, and he was like, to Dad, he was like, "Yeah, you can come in, but like," he was like, "the two girls have to wait outside. They're not allowed into the clubhouse." And Dad was like, "What do you mean they're not allowed into the clubhouse? Is it like an age thing or whatever?" He was like, they're whatever age. I think we were maybe 16 at the time. He was like, no, this is just, it's men only." And again, Dad was just kind of like, "I don't know what we've got ourselves in for." And there's been a couple of events like that where it's like, or even recently enough, we were over in Florida. This is maybe just before COVID, I'd say. So 2020, we're talking about, where we'd gone into a clubhouse down in Florida. There was golf on the TV, and we'd gone in for something to eat. I think it was after a round or whatever. And Leona and Leona's caddy, and we were going to sit and watch the golf. And kind of we'd taken a seat in the restaurant, and this lady comes over and she was like, "I'm actually going to have to ask you to leave." And we were like, "Oh, sorry, whatever, is the table reserved?" And she was like, "No." She was like, to Leona's caddy, to Gary, she was like, "You can stay, but the two girls can't." So it was like a men only sort of like area within the clubhouse. So there's still a lot of that. In golf, it's definitely got better. You know, the likes of the Women's British Open was at Muirfield this year for the first time ever. They've only kind of recently started kind of accepting women members, and it's the first time that it's been on the Women's British Open rota. So it is, the tides are kind of starting to turn slightly, but it's still, there's very much still a gender.
Is there any left in Ireland where it's male only? Has Portmarnock changed?
I think there was definitely a court case back a number of years back that kind of, and to have the rule kind of overturned, and it wasn't overturned. I think you can technically join. I still don't know if it's kind of your husband has to be a member before
you
can join.
Or would you want
to join
if they were like that?
But yeah, no, there's clubhouses still very much so. It's the ladies' clubhouse and there's the men's clubhouse, and you can't go into the clubhouse unless you're invited by a male, which is kind of baffling in this day and age.
Where would you like women's sports to go? I think maybe that's probably the answer, is to have parity. Mm-hmm. But is there anywhere else where you'd like to see, you know, women excelling? Is there with sport in general that women play?
I think the expectation that, you know, women can be professional athletes too, and not just seeing it as, you know, it's, that was the thing too, I suppose, in when we were in college in the States, it was like it's women's golf and it's women's soccer, and it's not just like golf and it's not soccer. You had to like specify which it was. And I suppose it'd be nice to see, you know, in the next couple of years, whether it's just, you know, I'm a golfer, I'm not a women's golfer, I'm not a women's soccer player or whatever else. It'd be nice to see that, you know, you're just as credible as kind of your male counterparts. You kind of, you work as hard, and you deserve the same recognition. It's not kind of looked down upon as lesser for essentially someone that puts in the same work and achieves the same sort of level of success.
And is talented.
Exactly.
A huge thanks to Lisa for her time and sharing her story. Our next episode will air next Sunday and will feature Cork sprinter Louise Shannon.
At 21 years old, I was still running the same time, and, you know, that time wasn't good for a 21-year-old, or, you know, it wasn't going to get you to championships and things like that. So that was a really tough kind of 5 or 6 years for me. And then one day I did a race in Belfast and I took, well, I halved the distance between my 2:08 and the Olympics, so I took 3 seconds off my time in one race. I think those years were incredibly tough for me.
Hear Me Roar was presented by me, Valerie Mackay, and produced and edited by Rory O'Hagan for Cork's Red FM. Music was by the wonderful Jack O'Rourke. Thanks to my friends at mygames.ie who created a beautiful memento for each of my special guests. Gaurav Magot, as Clusa Hurtamanov, Ogaspeg Mea Kaintlev Galua. Slán.
Hear Me Roar with Valerie Mulcahy is funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.